Okay.
That's all you need on that.
Yeah. That one time you were talking to me, you were telling me how you happened to be hired.
I worked at another firm. I shouldn't name it probably because it's slightly against them, but I'm going to say downtown. And I was an offset pressman, plate maker, and artist. And the business was bad in those days, and they would lay me off when there was nothing to do that day. So I'd scurry around and get orders, and I got quite a little business. And then one day I decided to go to Lansing, and I got a tremendous order from the state of Michigan for title certificates for automobiles. And I went to what was then the Kalamazoo Stove Company and got an order from them for 5 million letterheads, which was a pretty good order in those days. Mm-hmm. This is back 1933 or so, right in the heart of the Depression.
Yeah.
And I took these orders in and laid them on the boss's desk, and he said, fine, I'll just take those and file them away. I said, no, you won't. First you pay me a commission, because I wasn't working for the company today. And he wouldn't do that. And then, of course, he realized, after he got to thinking, that we had to buy larger press to run orders like this. The company wouldn't do that, and that sort of got me down on them. And they had no courage, in other words. And I knew I could get quite a lot of business like that. So I came out and talked to Uncle Jake. I didn't know any better. I was a young fellow. And he talked to me, but he did no more than give me a little encouragement. He told me to go home and write him a letter, which I did. And this went on. I came out here every 10 days, just about, for a year. And then he hired me one day, all of a sudden. And he was a man who was always testing people. He sent Don McDowell, the personnel manager, to our house and said that Friday night, after 5, and said, would you come to work Monday? Well, he didn't expect me to come to work Monday. In fact, I'm sure he hoped I wouldn't. Well, I said, I can't do that. I have to give my present employer a couple of weeks or so notice. And Don went back and reported this to Uncle Jake. And Uncle Jake himself then called me up and said, fine, you report to work on such and such a date. And I found out afterwards, he told me, in fact, that he hired me the first time I came out here, but he wanted to see if I wanted a job bad enough to work for. This is the way the man was. Mm-hmm. He had little ways of testing people. There was one incident about that time that happened. Henry Dobb, you know, I don't know if you're acquainted with him or not, his nephew worked in the mill. Well, Henry and I were old acquaintances. He played baseball for this company, KBP, and I had played at that time years before, for Checker Cab. And we came out, and that's the first time I met Henry, but that was years before that. At any rate, Hank went home on a vacation trip one time and brought back, I don't know how many plants, a tobacco plant. Hank's dad had raised tobacco. Well, Uncle Jake was just tickled to death, and they planted this tobacco in the back of the Kindleberger house and raised it and got a nice little crop of tobacco. Well, tobacco has to be this was good quality tobacco, Spanish Burley, and it has to be aged after it's brought along at a certain time and everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Uncle Jake was like a little kid with this. He was just excited about raising some tobacco. It was sort of a hobby with him. And when they picked it finally and put it up to cure, it has to cure, I don't know how long, but a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, Uncle Jake was buying cigars downtown, and he took this leaf down there to the man, the cigar maker, and he was going to cure it. And Hank had been raised in a family that had tobacco as one of their main crops down at West Carrollton, Ohio. And he warned his uncle, Uncle Jake, not to try to make cigars out of that tobacco for a certain period of time till it cured properly. But this is a thing that illustrates the man's mind. He went down to this tobacco maker and got after him to make a couple of dozen cigars right away from this tobacco leaf. Mm-hmm. And of course the cigars would be awful because the tobacco wasn't cured. And he had this box of these nice, beautiful looking cigars on his desk. And when a salesman came in that he particularly disliked, he would offer the poor man one of these rank, strong cigars and light it for him right away, and the salesman would have to sit there and smoke it, and if he wasn't, unless he was courageous, he'd have to say, oh, what a wonderful cigar. And Uncle Jake would sit there with his mouth covered up, just enjoying this poor man's suffering, and despising the man because he wouldn't tell him this is a terrible cigar, but you get these things. It's an illustration of the way the man tested people.
Was he rather impulsive?
In some ways, he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite dogmatic and a strong-minded person. When he made up his mind about something, if you wanted to argue with him, you'd better have some pretty good evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something really strong to argue about.
But if you had your point, why?
He longed for people to stand up to him and argue with him. He really did. And I think in his own way, sort of despised people that wouldn't, you know, speak up.
Uh-huh.
If they disagreed or if they felt strongly he was wrong about something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, when was it that you came out here?
1935.
Mm-hmm. Did you move out here then?
No, we moved out here. In fact, at his request, we moved out here about a year after that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was made a superintendent then and to start a new department, and he wanted me. It was a 24-hour-a-day department, and he wanted me handy. And I was handy, all right. I'd get up in the middle of the night and go to the mill. But that's what was expected. See, they used to work people 13 hours night shift and 12 hours day shift years ago. Not in my time, before my time.
Uh-huh.
I don't see how they stood it. 6 days a week.
Well, they have to live out here.
They didn't, though. A lot of them rode bikes, and they used to be an interurban that went out this way, you know. And I don't know how they, some of them would walk out from town. This was a very, very small community.
Yeah.
When we moved out here, there were only no more than 700 living here.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a good 2,000 working in the mill. And we figure the families of that 2,000, there must have been, that would have taken 5,000, 6,000 people in the community for everybody to live here that worked here.
What about housing at that time?
There wasn't very much.
Mm-hmm.
Up the hill, there wasn't any. It was just a rare farmhouse scattered here and there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a little collection right down here in this immediate vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
Houses along Riverview Drive, some of them are still sitting here. And
now, they built company houses for people to live in? Or?
They built company houses and they rented them for $20 and $22 a month. In fact, the house where the credit union was over here on the corner of Riverview and Parch Mountain, you know, across from the Standard Oil Station, the old.
Yeah.
That's where we lived when we first moved out here. And Doc Salson lived just up the street, a couple of houses, and some of the other men lived right along here at that time.
On this street right here, Island?
Yes.
Or?
On Riverview Drive.
Uh-huh.
And Parch Mountain. In Glendale, but right down here, right close.
Yeah. So you would be handy.
Too handy.
Yeah. Well, now, when did you move up the hill then?
Oh, those houses were built, and the financing was handled by the company, but we each selected our own plan, and that was in 1939. The project was started in the fall of 38. We moved up there in 39. And those houses were built by Miller Davis Construction Company, Miller Lumber, you know. Mm-hmm. And O.F. Miller and Uncle Jake met with us, and we hashed over what we wanted inside and out, and how we wanted our yards fixed and so forth. And despite all the legends and stories about how he would make people, bully people into doing things or frighten them into it, mm-hmm. never once was there any pressure put on anyone up there to have a house other than what they wanted mm-hmm. and thought they could afford.
And then he built them, is that it?
Miller Davis built them, and he took care of all the financing until it came time to sign us, for us to sign up with the bank downtown and make the deal. Now, for instance, I signed up with the Birdie, the Fidelity Savings and Loan.
Yeah.
And most of them did, I believe. But things were so simple in those days financially. I mean, I got 4% interest on my house, on the financing of it. Started out at 5%, and because I didn't miss any payments for a couple of years, it dropped to 4% automatically.
Oh.
Isn't that nice?
Now, were certain streets designated that they were going to build first, or?
The building was done, that group of build houses, 22 homes, were built up Parchmount.
Those were the first?
Those were the first ones.
And then they went over to Glendale?
No, I shouldn't say that. I don't really know. There were houses on Glendale up about two blocks, maybe three, two and a half blocks. Up, I should think about to this side of the church, just this side, just one block. There were several houses on there. And there were houses along Parch Mount, a few, not too many, I guess. 7 or 8 or 10, maybe. I don't know really. I can't remember.
Did they have any civic activities?
Oh my, yes. Wonderful. Really wonderful. Don McDowell was a musician of considerable skill and musical director of considerable skill. They had a quartet. They had a band. This is all company sponsored. This was a benevolent oligarchy, this whole thing. And Uncle Jake would pick up the tab if there wasn't any other way to pay for it. And you want to remember that in today's day, when a man like this gets a couple hundred thousand a year, he was getting probably 25,000 a year. I don't know, but I would suspicion that. This is in 35, 36, 37. And they would put on a 4th of July extravaganza, and it really was. It was a beautiful program. They'd have the band and fireworks and big party, and everybody was invited, and people came from town, of course, that had no connection. And the park over here was just filled with people. There was a large crowd would come out, 18,000-20,000 people. And then they'd have singing. They had a small choir, church choir, 30 people or so. And then Henry Dobb was one of the singers, his nephew, and quite good. And there was a Harry Gott was a tenor, a beautiful lyric tenor voice. And Ed Francois, who ran the machine shop, was one of the singers, and I can't remember who the other one was now. There was a quartet of men that were really excellent. And they would put on, at Christmas time, they would put on a Christmas party. And we always used to remember, think what a remarkable speaker Doc Southam was. Well, he was. He had a very inspirational manner of speaking. One day after I'd worked here.
Excuse me, this isn't Brown Company anymore, is it?
No, that's next door.
Next door.
Okay.
That way.
Thank you.
Up the
steps. This building used to be.
That's right. One day after I worked here, I think 4, maybe 5 years, and it worked into this, what they called, they had a policy team that they met when they were going to make a major move, and we would sit and chew the fat about it and argue about which way to jump and so forth. And so I had gotten to know Doc by then, and he was sales manager then. Uh-huh. And I used to think, what I'd give to be able to speak like this in front of a group, you know.
Uh-huh.
Everybody would be right sitting right up and just really eating it up. And I was sitting up on the stage, and Doc came in and from the back and was going to sit next to me. And he put his hand on my shoulder, and his hand was trembling, and I said, matter, Doc, are you ill? Oh no, he said, I'm always like this.
When he's going to speak, yeah?
He's terrified, and yet you never know it. He's marvelous the way he would speak.
Mm-hmm.
And when he'd get up and get started, he'd be all right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I used to think there was something wrong with me because I'd have butterflies if I had to get up in front of a group of people, especially people I knew.
Uh-huh.
And I find this comforted me to know that a man like him, who was such a good speaker, had the same feeling.
Uh-huh.
Said he never got over it.
Oh. Now, you were talking about this group that made policies. Who was in that group?
Kind of a mixture of people. People from the mill, people from very top management, not necessarily like the board of directors or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
This was a council sort of for people like John Wood, who was general manager then, mm-hmm. and Doc Salton, who was sales manager at that point,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Hayward, Ralph Hayward, was the president. Uncle Jake became chairman of the board a year and a half after I came out here.
Mm-hmm.
And they just picked up people who had studied engineering, metallurgy, chemistry, that had practical working knowledge of the mill, and not in a narrow sense, but in the whole picture of the mill, and people who weren't afraid to say, you're crazy, it should be this way. And Bob Kane was an excellent example of this. He was at that time a foreman in the bond room.
Oh.
And he was a very intelligent type person. He could argue with you and have a real good fight with you, and the next day you're the best of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an excellent quality.
Yeah.
And he was, for that reason, was one of those people.
Uh-huh.
And I can't remember now who all was on it. Charlie Gibbs was the chief engineer then. He's long gone.
Oh, that's Grace's.
That's right. People of that sort were on this group. There was a group of about, it varied depending on the project. If it was, for instance, we were going to buy a new paper machine, a Yankee, which turned out glazed paper, smooth finished paper, because we'd gone into rotogravure, which was my field. And we found that the M machine finished, MF, the Bagley and Beloit, the paper was too rough for gravure printing. And we were into that quite heavily. And we had to buy paper outside because of that. So we met and chewed the fat and argued, discussed, and finally bought the Yankee, and contracted for it, and it was built. And we made a major mistake in the first Yankee. The thing is made up. There's a huge chrome-plated drum that the paper goes over to take the smooth finish of it, duplicate the chrome, mm-hmm. the smooth, slick finish of the chrome, similar to ironing a damp shirt with an iron.
Oh.
This is a heated drum, and the paper comes up on it, slightly damp, theoretically, and takes the glaze, the finish of that chrome-plated drum, and then goes on through other drums and finish drying. First it goes over a number of drums so that it won't fall apart, you know, when it comes
yeah.
and goes over this big forming drum, glazed finish drum, but we put that drum too far forward so that the paper was too dry and didn't get as good a finish as it should have. And after
Parchment Library. Yeah.
Thank you.
is it my writing? Mm-hmm. Well, hold that one and I'll call you back. I'm interviewing Phil right now. Okay, mm-hmm. Bye.
After some pretty hot discussions, we then ordered Yankee 2 after a few years had gone by,
uh-huh.
and resolved that problem so that the paper off Yankee 2 is better finished. Not that one was not usable, but it just wasn't as good as it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Smooth, you know.
Well, now, was it your design that you told them to build it? Is that it? I mean, this company says this is the way we want it, and they build it.
Our engineering people,
yeah.
Ralph Clark, Charlie Gibbs, people of that sort,
mm-hmm.
were the ones that finally met with the people, the paper machine manufacturing firm, to work out all the details.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very complex thing to design a paper machine, because you start out with 99% water and 1% pulp, and soaks the water through a screen and the wire, and as they say, and comes gradually to where it's firm enough to come off that screen. It's formed enough, so it will go now over some steam drums to start drying. And all of this has to be done with, if you can imagine a machine that's being heated up to dry, like you're ironing a shirt, to use the old anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
The drums all expand. The drums have to be driven, and the peripheral speed, the surface speed of these drums, all has to be just right so it won't break the paper,
mm-hmm.
because they expand as they heat up.
Mm-hmm.
And as you change the steam in various drums to adjust the heat factor, there's an expansion factor to worry about too.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, these drums are all driven, and this huge big drum with the chrome on it is all driven.
Mm-hmm.
And then the drums afterwards are. And the further up you go in the drying system, the less chance of a web break. A break on a paper machine is a catastrophe.
Oh, I can imagine.
It's a mess.
Because it takes, I suppose, the grip this way to pull the rest of it through.
And mm-hmm. they have to feed it through the whole machine, web up the whole machine again.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You probably saw quite a lot of changes from the time you came here.
Yes, quite a lot.
In the growth of the company.
As I remember, when I came here, there was approximately $14 million a year in business.
Mm-hmm.
And in an amazingly short period of time, we were approaching $100 million a year in business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in years, hard to say exactly, but I would say by 15 to 16, 17 years from then, we were approaching $100 million a year.
Fantastic.
And this was at the expense of a great deal of blood, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
It was men like Hayward and Forrest Christie, who was sales manager and vice president, Doc Salson, who was, I don't know what his title was at that time, he was above Christie. And of course, your chief engineers, your sales managers in the various cities. At that time, our sales setup was that there would be a sales manager in Chicago and Minneapolis and Los Angeles and New York and so forth,
mm-hmm.
Atlanta, wherever the market centers were for our product. And then these managers would report back to the sales manager, the executive sales manager of the company. And business just seemed to, we lined up with Procter & Gamble. At that time we had, by 1950 or 55, we had approximately 95% of their paper overwrap business. Not their board, but their paper,
mm-hmm.
not their carton. Of course, the soap business, which was a thing that built us up real fast, Procter & Gamble was a marvelous big piece of business. Became detergent business rapidly in the early 60s, you know. The soap business died off.
Is that where the change in KVP came?
We had to, at that time, we had to adjust our marketing and produce other types of wraps. Mm-hmm. For instance, Duncan Hines Cake Mix wrap for Procter & Gamble. We did almost all of that and pioneered in it.
Mm-hmm.
An eight-color process gravure printing. And it meant sticking your chin out and buying expensive machinery, paper-making machinery, Yankee 1 and Yankee 2, and coating machinery, and to make the paper before we could even print it. And then it meant buying wax finishing equipment, rewinders, all that sort of equipment. It meant enlarging our shipping, because now we're dealing with a lot of small rolls of paper that go out. It's finished, ready to go into their packaging machine. And the beautiful part of it was with Procter & Gamble, they would just say to us, here's what we want, here's a sketch, here's an artist's colored drawing, just a rough sketch. Develop a wrapper and get set to produce so many million of them a year for us. And we never had any problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
That was all. They would never leave us dangling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a difficult type of decision for a company to make in any manufacturing process. For example, a Bisquick, which is an immense amount of wrapping paper to make, to wrap Bisquick, and they wanted us to take on their account. Hershey Bar wanted us to take on their account. And the company, and this was, I think, was good long-range planning, decided against it because it would have taken up Bisquick, for example, would have taken half of our entire output of our two Yankee machines, which was wonderful. Look at all that wonderful business. You're crazy to turn it down, you think. But what happens if you lose it? Your company, your plant is down.
Yeah.
And you've got to scurry around and find a new bunch of customers, sometimes a lot of them, to take care of that one big void that Bisquick left.
Mm-hmm.
And in case of Procter & Gamble, that was perhaps 10 or 12% of our total output. And a marvelous rapport between their management and our management. Personal trust and liking and acknowledging skills on both sides, of the management people, so that there was little chance, unless we were just utterly stupid, of losing the account. Our price, no holds barred, go over the whole cost system with them. They would expect us to take a certain profit. This is enlightened thinking in business, but you do find it in some businesses, not too many.
When did they start expanding, like in Espanola?
I think it was 1945, right after World War II.
What was the reason for that?
Well, to get an assured source of pulp, of the right kind of pulp. This 6,000 square miles of land that they leased from the Canadian government had a great deal of it was the right kind of timber and was accessible. The terrain was such that you could get in and get the pulpwood out. And there were all kinds of factors involved. There was a plant there which was in bad shape. It had been used as a POW camp in World War II. And had to have a lot of rebuilding done. But that's what I believe killed Mr. Hayward. He just was up there working day and night. That was his project, really. And he just drove himself right into the grave. He had diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't take care of himself. He just thought, well, this can't happen to me. We all can. Mrs. Hayward was very upset, but she couldn't do anything about it.
Now, did they do something besides cut the pulpwood up there? Did they make paper
up
there too?
Oh, yes. They have two paper machines. They have sold that, of course.
Oh, it isn't.
The Brown Company got rid of that to the Eddy Paper Company which is a Canadian Eddie paper company, no connection with our Eddie paper down here. And they sold it about 5 years ago, I believe.
Oh, wasn't there another company or another place that Brown or KDP had a company or not?
Oh yes, there were a number of branches. We had a these were mostly converting plants. We had one in Devon in Pennsylvania. We had a plant in Houston. None of these, I believe, are operating now. Mm-hmm. We had a plant in Chicago. We had a plant in New Jersey, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are still operating. And then, of course, at the time of the Brown Company taking over KVP and Sutherland, there were a number of other companies involved in that. They owned or were buying at that time. And this was a considerable lesson in financing.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I better not go into that because it's a thing that many of us were quite shocked about, that it could have happened. Because we had merged with Sutherland, and Sutherland had been in considerable trouble in that they had equipment that wasn't being operated to its full capacity.
Just a moment.